The only school that teaches you about money is the School of Hard Knocks. Until now.
You need to learn this business, and this is the time to do it.
Become an insider. So you have to know the rules before you get in the game.
Welcome to the Money MBA Podcast.
Oh, have I got your attention now?
Where you'll learn how to be a master of money.
There's so many ways to make money today.
Let me show you in 2 seconds flat why the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Now here's your host, Jonathan Cutsmita.
Welcome to the Money MBA Podcast. Today's guest is Joseph Walker. Now, it's a name that might not yet be familiar, but it soon will be. Joe's also a podcaster. He hosts a show called the Jolly Swagman Podcast. He's an Aussie guy, so a lot of that has to do with what's going on in the Aussie economy, in particular the housing market. Recently, Joe did a 7-interview series called the Housing Bubble Week, kind of like Shark Week, almost just as scary considering how out of control the Aussie housing market has become. That's not the only thing we discuss. In fact, Joe's research and what he's taken away from the interviews he's done apply to just about any market, even the US housing market. So this was an opportunity for Joe to discuss the things he took away from the interviews he did on that series. There's a lot that we cover. There's a lot that we discuss. So without any further ado, let's jump in. Please welcome Joseph Walker to the Money MBA Podcast. Joe Walker, welcome to the podcast. Man, I appreciate you taking the time to join me and talk about your research, what you're seeing over there in the Aussie housing market, and also share with my audience a little bit more about your podcast and the incredible 7-episode series you did entitled Housing Bubble Week. So first of all, your podcast is called the Jolly Swagman Podcast. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct.
What the heck is a swagman?
A swagman. Well, swagman. Swagmen were like bush travelers in Australian folklore. So they would move from place to place. They were sort of itinerants and they would carry swags. We have these things called swags, which is almost like a combination of a mattress and a sleeping bag. you can kind of roll up and carry with you. So swagmen would travel around looking for work on various stations and farms. And there's an Australian kind of ballad, which is almost like our unofficial national anthem called Waltzing Matilda. And Okay. The song is about, the lyrics are about a jolly swagman. So when my mate Angus and I started this podcast a couple of years ago, he stepped back from the podcast since. He lives in New York now. But he wanted to call it the Jolly Swag Man, and I couldn't think of a good name, so I was like, yeah, we'll go with that. It's fine. It's kind of a silly name. It doesn't make sense, but it has some virtues. It's kind of flexible, so it lets me do whatever I want. I think as long as the content's good, the name could be anything. As long as it's not too long and as long as it's spelt phonetically, actually. Those are my two caveats.
those are the podcast rules.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's got a killer theme song. I'm not kidding. Like, that thing gets me pumped.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, look, this is, even the outro is solid. So you guys do quality work. Your research is amazing. And so you did this Housing Bubble Week. Is this a passion of yours, or is it just ironic because it seemed like Australia is kind of going through the final stages of a housing bubble?
No, it is a passion of mine. It's probably the overriding topic of concern in my life as of recently. I started looking into it a couple of years ago, but I mean, I have no formal finance or economics training, very much self-taught in this regard, but I quickly cottoned onto the fact that it was probably the most important story in Australia, over the medium term. And it was being very poorly told. It wasn't very well understood. The quality of the conversation was impoverished. And I thought that's just a perfect opportunity. The podcast series, or my work on the housing bubble, I almost think of as like a startup. like I'm solving a problem. So it is a passion of mine.
Well, you definitely tackled it like that. Now, when you were reaching out, were these, there's 7 episodes, and for those tuning in, check out the Jolly Swagman podcast, Housing Bubble Week, incredible work. I mean, the body of work here, I think, is completely underestimated and probably overlooked. Just even little things, as both a writer, podcaster, and someone who's also self-taught, very interested in markets, there are certain aspects of these episodes, like even your intro, like it's very well thought out, very well written. And I think it really brings people into what each episode is instead of, you know, my pathetic attempt here, which is like, hey, how you going? Let's start a conversation. It was definitely
I do a little bit of that too.
So these 7 episodes, were these the 7 that you wanted to engage with? Was it the ones you sought out right away?
Well, many of them were. There are lots of other people I could have spoken to. And some of those people are actually coming up as interviews. So, you know, if I could have picked anyone in the world and forced them to come on my podcast for a 7-part housing bubble week, it might have been slightly different, but not 100% different. The people I ended up going with, I already knew more or less what they were going to say, what their work was, because I've been studying this subject in so much depth, but I wanted to bring them to the public. And the series had a definite sequence as well. I tried to sort of structure it.
Absolutely. Now, was that pre-planned, or is it just you talked to one guy and then the next guy was lined up, or were they kind of all over the place and then you just decided the order later?
I decided the order later, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting, because the sequence was definitely there. It flowed incredibly well.
Yeah.
And so you started out with, what was the gentleman's name again? Dean Baker.
Mm.
And this was an economist. And for my audience, which is going to be primarily in the United States, this is an important conversation. Although the majority of your interviews are heavily focused on what's going on in Australia, they basically are relatable to whatever market you're in. And you reference historic bubbles in other markets, Ireland quite extensively. But your first episode, you're communicating with Dean Baker and some of the predictions that he made. Were there any key takeaways that you took from that conversation that immediately apply to Australia and really anybody could kind of glean from and use in their own marketplace?
Yeah. Dean's big insight was looking at the difference between the user cost of housing and the cost of renting. And that was the indicator for him. It's a little more sophisticated than a straight up price to rent ratio. His other big insight was, you know, Dean says all you needed to spot this bubble was a little bit of confidence and some understanding of basic arithmetic. Like, it didn't take great genius. Now, maybe Dean is just kind of lucky after the fact. Maybe he just kind of struck gold in his prediction. But I think there is something to it, because the way he went about identifying the American housing bubble and the consequences it would have for your economy was so sort of intuitive and straightforward. Because after identifying, you know, the bubble, he next went on to look at, like, well, what are the effects of this bursting going to be for consumption in terms of a negative wealth effect? But more straightforwardly, what will the effect be on GDP growth and jobs when the construction industry shrinks back to normal size? So housing bubbles have historically been accompanied by construction booms. Because when the prices are astronomical, yet construction costs remain relatively stable, there's really fat margins for developers there to flood into the market and just start whacking up apartments and developing on housing lots. So you often see this a construction boom go hand in hand with a housing bubble, and that's almost predicted by a concept in economics known as Tobin's Q. But once that happens and construction kind of takes up an outsized place in the economy, you can kind of if you see it reverting back to the mean, that is a channel by which a housing bubble can lead to a recession. In Australia, it's a similar story, though not quite as aggressive as America and Ireland. I think construction employs 9-ish percent of our workforce at the moment and accounts for about 8% of GDP. I think historically, the longer term average has been closer to 6% in terms of construction's contribution to GDP.
Which is interesting because in that interview, he pinpoints construction spending as, even if we didn't have the financial crisis, he separates the two. The financial crisis is something different than the recession itself. He said it was still plainly obvious that there would be a recession caused by housing because you had this big run-up in GDP in construction, and that there would basically be, you know, an overshoot the other direction. So, I mean, it would probably, you know, lend to believe that in Australia you'll see the same thing. If typically it's 6%, now it's 8%, the pullback's going to be, maybe we'll say 4%. What's going to fill that GDP gap for Australia was the same question he proposed for the U.S. Do you kind of see anything filling that gap yourself personally, or is it?
Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, I guess we've kind of benefited in terms of iron ore prices recently. Thank you, Brazil. And people talk about the infrastructure spending program being run by Australian governments. The problem with government infrastructure programs is that they're not qualitatively or quantitatively sufficient to replace the decline in residential construction. So put simply, they're just not the same jobs. Like tradies, you know, and brickies aren't the same sort of people who are going, like, they're not going to be saved by government infrastructure programs, those jobs. So that's a definite threat to the economy, but there are a number of other channels by which a housing bubble bleeds into a recession. So people talk about the negative wealth effect. We have that. And also there are other jobs that depend on volume of housing transactions. So finance, insurance, and real estate jobs. Fire accounts for about 20% of our GDP in value additive terms. So what's also at risk is, you know, the real estate agents, the bank lenders, people whose jobs depend on, you know, through commissions and salaries, depend on a large turnover in housing. Because what you see in bubbles, there's a very strong price volume correlation. And in a down market, the volume of sales dries up. So that's another big risk for Australia's economy.
Well, it just wipes out that whole sector entirely, anybody who's ultimately connected to it.
Including the agents and the
lending officers. So he also talks about, first of all, I guess maybe taking a step back, how would you define a bubble? I think this is a theme that you came back to multiple times and challenged people on, because I think if you don't get that right, you can't have an intelligent conversation about whether any market or any sector is in a bubble.
Yeah. And like, I think this is just such an important point, but it's easily overlooked or minimized or derided. When we have these conversations, fundamentally, we're using words, and words are very, very slippery things. People attach different meanings to the same word sometimes, and it leads to a very messy conversation. Verbal reasoning can be incredibly imprecise unless you clearly define exactly what it is you're talking about at the outset. And one of my gripes in conversations about the Australian housing market is almost the universal confusion about what a quote-unquote bubble really is. I proliferate myself across different property investor Facebook groups or online forums, or, you know, I go to events, I talk to people, and the confusion is palpable. A lot of people think that a bubble is like this kind of hallucination or illusion. I think that conception of a bubble is derived from very salient historical examples of, you know, the South Sea bubble, maybe Tulip Mania, or the Beanie Baby or Catfish bubbles more recently, right. Where something that's like clearly a very inherently replaceable commodity or has patently not much worth, you know, almost overnight skyrockets in price. And those things are certainly bubbles, but the more common and ironically more devastating version of a bubble is a housing bubble. And housing bubbles always emerge out of good fundamentals. So they're not so much born in the absence of, but kind of midwifed or bootstrapped into existence by healthy fundamentals. Whether it's a regional housing bubble, which emerges around something like a, you know, a new train line or some special geographic feature, or whether it's a more national housing bubble, which comes about as a result of a story about population growth or government-sponsored housing programs or financial liberalization, whatever it is. But usually it's a confluence of stories, which is an even more powerful cocktail. And we see this in housing bubbles throughout the last 40 or 50 years, which is really when national housing bubbles have become a thing, you know, in the era of national media and modern banking. And once the bubble is born into existence through strong fundamentals, it then begins to take on a life of its own as people react to price increases. And at this point, the rationalizations become post hoc. Stories are used to explain away the price increases, where really they're being driven by speculation. So that's kind of like a phenotypic or characteristics-based or narrative-based description of a housing bubble. But to go back to your core question, how would I define one? It really has two key components, which is one, the divergence between market price and intrinsic value. And a lot of people stop there, which is erroneous. The second key component is that divergence is driven by speculation or extrapolative beliefs on the part of investors. So that is the stylized definition of a bubble. People are not precise when they define it. Housing bubbles are basically in accordance with that template, but I would proffer that the investors are less cynical arbitrageurs riding the bubble and more true believers, because housing bubbles are dominated by amateurs, typically, not by professional or institutional investors. So there are more people who genuinely are just not very sophisticated and who genuinely believe the stories and the myths and narratives swirling around the bubble. So we, in economics, we would describe the situation as having, you know, heterogeneous agents. And that means that it's not as liquid. It doesn't shoot up and down as quickly as, you know, a stock market bubble. But true believers and the cynical arbitrageurs can still dance to a different tune. You know, the cynical arbitrageurs stop once the music stops, but the true believers can unlearn their beliefs about the bubble. So ultimately, even though the flavor of investors is slightly different in a housing bubble, the result is still the same.
So I was just trying to peek through my notes here. I have you at one point describing it in three elements. So obviously you have this dislocation between price and intrinsic value.
Yeah.
The real core piece is that this is happening as a result of speculation with the intent of making capital gains.
Mm.
Where is my second piece that I'm missing here? Where is the possible second element that you consider when looking at a bubble?
So we have a good story, like good fundamentals, bringing the bubble into existence, speculation about prices that then drives up the market price above the intrinsic value. But I should say something about the divergence between the market price and the intrinsic value. So there are a couple of broad approaches to actually gauging what is the intrinsic value of a property. And that's quite a difficult question. The first approach revolves around this notion of quote-unquote fundamentals. And fundamentals are a collection of variables that we think should affect prices. So things like incomes, interest rates, population growth, housing supply, which is the net flow of existing stock onto the market, plus new construction. That's one way to think about bubbles. I have a fundamental philosophical problem with the fundamentals view of intrinsic value, because fundamentally, it constitutes an after-the-fact rationalization. So if we sort of think about this in a Humean sense, we can't like directly observe the effect that interest rates has on prices. Like that's not something that physically exists in the world that we can measure. So after the fact, we do some mathematical modeling and we say that it had this effect. But the risk there is that you're omitting certain variables and that you're overfitting to, you know, the data that's in front of you, especially if you're using a very short time series of, you know, a couple of decades or more. Now, the problem also is going back to what I was saying about how housing bubbles are typically born, is usually there is some good sort of fundamentals underpinning them and the bubble's an overlay. So that's the very pernicious thing. They're kind of cloaked by this kernel of truth, which economists or investors who have an interest in or you know, believe in the essential truth of the story are able to kind of torture those fundamentals after the fact to explain away the housing bubble. So that's one approach to gauging intrinsic value, which I am skeptical of. The second approach goes back to Irving Fisher and 1933, and you know, even before Irving Fisher, but that's basically that the intrinsic value of an asset is how much cash flow it brings you discounted back to the present. So assume you're going to hold, assume you're a property investor and you buy an apartment in Sydney and you assume you're going to hold it forever. The intrinsic value of that apartment isn't some weird complex equation about, you know, incomes and population growth in that suburb or whatever. The intrinsic value, if you're holding it forever, is how much cash that's generating for you through rents discounted back to the present. So rents are the key here. That's the secret for gauging the intrinsic value of housing. So one of the things I think is good to look at when you're trying to identify the existence of a housing bubble is a price to rent ratio, which comes with a few caveats. For example, in Australia, we've had low and declining interest rates since the 80s, and low interest rates naturally leads to lower rents and higher prices. One reason it leads to lower rents, if anything, is just because landlords can get cheaper mortgages, so they can kind of lower and still get a spread, but even if they lower their rents. So interest rate and a low interest rate environment might lead you to think that the equilibrium kind of shifts upwards in terms of the price to rent ratio, but it doesn't explain the whole story. The other point to make on that is that Australia's had other periods of low interest rates where we haven't seen a commensurate run up in house prices. So, and you know, people were circulating the same story in your American housing bubble that it's because of low interest rates, you know, housing's more affordable. There are so many problems with that argument, which we can discuss. But to come back to the basic idea, I think a price to rent ratio is a pretty good rule of thumb, kind of heuristic approach to identifying that divergence between market price and intrinsic value. Because we're using, obviously, price goes to the question of market price and rents go to the question of intrinsic value. So if you put me on a desert island and said, I need you to tell me which countries have housing bubbles, and then I'll let you off the island and you're only allowed like one metric, I would ask to see price to rent ratios over time, and then I would try to leave the island.
Well, you're stuck in Sydney for now. So to kind of summarize that in a super, super simplistic way, especially when it comes to real estate, is if you don't have cash flow, you don't really have value. And everything else after that is just speculating on future price gains or capital gains, which at the end of the day, and I don't want to oversimplify this, but at the end of the day is kind of the Ponzi element to what feeds the bubble. And you reference, I was hoping to kind of keep it in sequence, but a lot of what you discussed with all these people is they kind of mishmash together. One of the things you talk about is Bill Gross's quote about the plankton theory. Can you talk about the plankton theory a little bit in terms of this speculative nature that there's always going to be that other buyer?
Yeah. Plankton theory is like, you commonly see lower quality homes with large price appreciation in housing bubbles. And that's one of the giveaways that underwriting standards have deteriorated. But it's also a natural consequence of the extrapolative beliefs. So if you look at like whether it's Paris in the 80s or Sydney in the 2000s, the bubble starts in a more sensible location, in an area with higher quality homes, tighter supply, and it emanates outwards as people are looking for analogous opportunities in adjacent suburbs, all the way to the opposite side of the city. And usually that takes you to the lower priced homes. The other thing in terms of lower priced homes is that lenders themselves are speculating on prices, and they feel, they too neglect the downside risks in a housing bubble. And they're more willing to offer credit to borrowers with, who are less credit worthy than the average borrower in normal times. And once you have a lot of people borrowing for the lower priced homes, what that does, it doesn't just push up the prices of the lower priced homes, it also enables the people selling them to trade up, and then they trade up into the medium priced homes, people selling the medium priced homes trade up into the high priced homes. And that's essentially Bill Gross's plankton theory. So in the ecosystem of the ocean, plankton are at the very bottom of the food chain. The little fish eat the plankton, the big fish eat the little fish, the sharks eat the big fish. And if you want to gauge the health of the ecosystem, you need to look at the plankton. You need to start at the very foundation. And that's his analogy for looking at credit expansion in housing bubbles. He calls it plankton theory.
Well, I think we're both kind of chuckling at each other as you're saying that, because if we were talking about a stock bubble, it would be more or less, we would be referring to that as the dumb money. It's the late to the game type of people. And in the housing market, it's those that aren't credit worthy, lower incomes, and in a normal, more equilibrium state, wouldn't be able to get into the market anyway. So now all of a sudden you have this kind of a euphoria that starts to get created. Credit cycles are a different conversation altogether, but you need that credit growth for this appreciation to happen, because the more credit there is, the more people can get into the market. Then you start to have a contraction of that, and the banks get nervous because they're not hitting their margins or their volume numbers, and they start to loosen up the credit guidelines, and then the plankton more or less can start to get into the game. But at that point, when that starts to happen, isn't the bubble almost baked into the into the cake at that point. It's just a matter of time. And you talk about cascades in terms of what's unique about a housing bubble is it may take 4 years for it to reach its peak, and it may take another 4 to 6 peak to trough. So a lot of times the wipeout isn't instantaneous. So, you know, people don't necessarily feel it the same way as you do with a, you know, parabolic stock bubble.
Yeah. Housing bubbles, you know, they stretch on for years, but they also take years to decline. So, you know, when we saw the dot-com bubble burst, the NASDAQ lost, like, God, wasn't it like 30% in a matter of months or something like that?
Yeah, it was even, I think, 40.
40 or 50, yeah. And then it had bottomed out in about 2.5 years or thereabouts. The average major housing bust takes 6 years peak to trough. And we would expect that given the relative illiquidity of housing markets and given the fact that they're very inertial. So house prices are very inertial. Bob Shiller and Chip Case have a fantastic paper on this from the 80s where they look at the momentum in housing prices. So a lot, you know, even in the middle of the down market, people are still kind of sitting on their hands, waiting for the opportunity. We still have the Mexican standoff between buyers and sellers. There's a coordination problem there. And these busts just drag out. And that in itself is something very interesting. And it also exposes another kind of like common misconception I constantly run into, which is, oh God, it's just horrible. Like, I was at this property seminar last night and the presenter was saying, he was kind of like trashing the headlines of, you know, 40% price falls and railing against the, you know, the scaremongering by some commentators and in the media.
Like Joseph Walker.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. He actually mentioned, he was like, yeah, this was at the end in conversation, but he said like, yeah, like, you know, 85% headlines. It's just ridiculous. We've never seen that before. And I was kind of smirking because that was in reference to my podcast with John Hempton, which was then picked up by the national media and kind of blew up, which was part of Housing Bubble Week. But I kind of kept my lips sealed. But what he was saying was that
you're like the new John Tepper.
Well, Tepper's a friend and a former guest of the podcast. But he was treated very unfairly by the Australian media back in 2016. But anyway, yeah. So this guy was saying, you know, this property seminar leader was saying that these claims that we're going to see 40 or 50% price falls are just totally ridiculous because prices have only fallen, you know, roughly 10% nationally. You know, we haven't had a crash. So these people were clearly wrong. And I'm just thinking, what on earth? Like, obviously these people haven't studied financial history. The price falls we've seen in Australia so far are precisely what you'd expect if we were in the early stages of one of those major world historic crashes. There's still time, in other words. Like, these things, they take a long time to play out. Housing crashes are like slow-moving train wrecks. Like, it takes a long time to kind of turn the ship around, so to speak. Although the damage is front-loaded in terms of the recession, prices don't bottom out for years after it.
Well, and with that in mind, two questions I have for you, because we've moved through a lot of different topics here, but we talked about, you know, the identifying a bubble, how important the separation between price and intrinsic value is. And at the end of the day, the if you were stranded on an island, the information you would really want to know to identify that bubble is that price to rent ratio, how important that cash flow element to it, how important the cash flow element is to identifying intrinsic value. So when it comes to the price to rent ratio, what is kind of a equilibrium number, or when at what point does it start to show signs that it's getting frothy or bubbly?
Yeah. Like, it's hard to give a blanket statement given the different contingencies in different countries' sort of histories. Atrilia, the real estate website, used to say, I think it was like a price to rent ratio above 15 or something like that, meant that it was more rational to rent as opposed to buy. Price to rent ratios in Sydney got up near 40x. Similar stories in cities in America and in Dublin during the US and Irish housing bubbles. So kind of price to rent ratios have been kind of like two times above the long term, roughly twice the long term equilibrium. Historically in America, you've seen something closer to 20x. So what that means is prices are 20 times the annual rental yield. And Australia is similar as well. Historically, it's been closer to 20x. Sydney and Melbourne, we got up to near 40.
Well, I mean, there's so many different layers to the conversation. When you look in the United States right now, some of these obscene marketplaces, like San Francisco, the Bay Area, for example.
Even here in Honolulu, I mean, we're seeing price to rent ratios of like 60.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where oftentimes this is where the speculators, certainly the ones that drive the narrative, like you went to see last night at this conference, it's a lot of, because it hasn't happened yet, it's not true. Whereas just because it hasn't happened yet doesn't mean it isn't about to become true. And it's like, you know, in these markets where right now in the US it's 60 to 1, 70 to 1 price to rent ratios. Like, well, look, we're at 70 to 1 and there's no crash, there's no crisis, this isn't a bubble. And it's like, yeah, well, you know, for the most part, just about everything returns to the mean. And affordability starts to become a really important topic to consider. And are you seeing that starting to become more of a factor where maybe you had a ton of liquidity flow into these major city markets for all the demographic reasons that it makes sense? And with that sloshing around of liquidity, the prices in a Sydney, a London, a New York, San Francisco goes through the roof, and then the market starts to spread out to find more affordability, and at the same time, more affordable places to start speculating. And that's where it really starts to kind of feed on itself. Is that something you would agree with, and certainly something you've probably seen here happen in Sydney in recent?
Yeah. One of the common counterarguments to this talk of housing bubbles is like, there's no such thing as one housing market. There's, you know, 20,000 housing markets in Australia. And while that is true to an extent, it's becoming less true, especially in an environment of national media and national banks. You see prices move in unison in just like totally geographically disconnected areas where it doesn't really make sense. So it's not just a Sydney and Melbourne housing bubble. We've seen prices get too high in, you know, some other capital cities, but also places like Newcastle, Geelong, Wagga Wagga, Tweed Heads, Tamworth, Coffs Harbour, like really bizarre places in Australia. Like Tamworth is up there in the top 100 or 200 least affordable cities in the world by price to income ratio. This is like a town of no more than about 20,000 in country New South Wales. You know, there's no shortage of land. Right. So you do see money not just like sloshing around the main cities, but also investors kind of like looking for opportunities in other areas. And that's a bit of a giveaway. Like, I don't know too much about Hawaii, And like to an extent, that's quite a desirable location. Supply might be constricted in certain areas. You know, if there are homes that are being competed for by the ultra wealthy, those really high price to rent ratios might make a little more sense. But if you start seeing really high price to rent ratios in like less desirable locations, that's a bit of a red flag for a housing bubble.
So once those tertiary markets start to get out of control, it's another smoke before the fire type of signal.
Yeah.
So let's take a quick break here. We're going to break up this interview into three parts. So we just wrapped up part one of the three-part series. Hopefully you've been enjoying my interview with Joseph Walker of the Jolly Swagman podcast. Come along now. Let's jump into part two, where there's even more great information we discuss. And I can't wait for you to continue the journey with us into what Joseph took away from his seven-part series, A Housing Bubble Week. I'm really proud to have Joe join me here on the Money MBA podcast. So without further delay, let's jump into part two of this three-part interview series.
Thank you for listening to the Money MBA podcast with your host, Jonathan Cutsmita.
It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates.
To access more great content, visit us online at moneymba.com.
That's where the money is. And more than that, control.
There's only one person in the world to decide what I'm going to do, and that's me.
And I am deadly serious about that. That's it. I'm done.